On this episode of Of Course Agility, my guest is Marge Vincent. And my guest today on Of Course Agility is Marge Vincent. And she is from, I know, like the West Coast area. Welcome to the podcast, Marge. And could you tell me where you're generally located?
I am currently living in Ontario, Oregon, which is a very eastern part of the state, actually fairly close to Boise, Idaho. It's more of a country area, but we really like the farmland and the openness.
Okay, very. That sounds nice. Being more in a New Jersey person, I appreciate when I get the chance to go to places where it's a little more open and different environments.
Exactly.
And now I'll ask, how did you first start in agility? How did you discover it or get involved?
Well, my husband and I had a couple of dogs, and we decided to go to the county fair. And that was in Sacramento, California, or San Jose, California, actually. And while we were at the fair, there was an agility demonstration. And my husband looked at me and said, I want to do that with our dogs. And I'm like, okay. So when the demonstration was over, we went down and talked to the person putting on the demonstration, which turned out to be Nancy Guise. And we signed up for classes, and it kind of went from there. So that was in the early 90s, and we got involved taking classes in the local area with her, and then we moved around to our we both worked at the same business, so our boss moved us to Sacramento, and while we were in Sacramento, we decided we wanted to continue with the agility. So my husband started building equipment so we could play in our backyards. We had no idea. We didn't know anybody. And we started training our own dogs. And someone down the street was doing herding lessons, and we would drive by their house every day after work. So we went down there and asked them if we could get into herding. And she said, well, I noticed that you're doing agility. Do you want to swap training? And we agreed, and I said, okay. And she says, well, I have a friend who wants to do agility too. So we started teaching a couple of people, and word of mouth came around. And next thing I know, we're teaching classes, and we have more students than we knew what to do with. So we ended up buying a big place and opening an agility training facility. And in the early 90s, when NADAC came to our area, she put on a seminar, Sharon Nelson, and we got involved a little bit with knowing her. And when Sharon started really pushing NADAC, she came to our facility in the late 90s and put on some fundraisers at our facility for the whole month of March. And we became really good friends. And our business was booming, and every year that Sharon and Becky came to do the fundraiser, we got to know them more and more. We would go to camps up in Cataldo, Idaho, where Sharon was putting on summer camps. And eventually, my husband and I retired from our day job and was just doing agility full time. And Sharon asked my husband if he wanted to tag along with Becky and Sharon while they promoted NADAC throughout the United States. And my husband, who always wanted to travel for retirement, said, yes, absolutely. So we sold our business to some really good agility friends that are still running the business under a different name. But we decided we would start traveling around the United States, putting on fundraisers for Sharon, promoting NADAC throughout the United States. And we did that for about, I would say, 8 years. We went around, did all the West Coast, Tennessee, the Midwest, Montana, getting NADAC more, the clubs involved with doing NADAC. And that's kind of how we started doing agility.
Wow. Okay. So
all over.
Yeah. So you've been in, now often I ask, my guess, you know, what venues you do, but it sounds like you've been involved with NADAC for a very long time. Is NADAC the only venue that you've done agility in, or have you done other ones?
Beginning when agility was very new, USDA was the only thing on the plate to do. When Sharon started doing NADAC in 95, I believe, we obviously got on the NADAC bandwagon, but we dabbled in AKC at the time, and we did a little CPE, but NADAC was always the one that we went back to. And when we started basically working for Sharon and promoting NADAC, it was the only venue that we did and right. have since then.
Right. So you've been, I want to say that I think you've, probably my first guest has been involved in agility for such a length of time. It seems, though, the dates you're mentioning seem like they're earlier than anyone I remember previously talking to. So you have been in the game for a long time.
Absolutely. My husband was the one that actually pushed more with the NADAC. He wanted to become a judge about a year after getting involved with NADAC, and him, and I don't know if you remember Paul Kirk.
I think I've heard the name, but I don't remember.
Okay,
him.
Paul Kirk is, gosh, he's got to be 86 now. Him and my husband Bruce both went to one of the first judges clinics to become a judge. And it went from there. And I think I became a judge a year later, thinking when we went on the road, we could judge our own trials. We didn't have to, you know, bring any other people in to help judge or whatever when we were putting on the shows. It was just me and my husband that put the fundraisers on. And it was fantastic. We made so many friends and got to see the country. We worked on the weekends and had the rest of the week to sightsee the areas that we went. It was just absolutely amazing.
Sounds very nice to me. It's kind of a dream that I would like to have in some ways, but it's nice to know that some people actually get to do that, travel around and go to trials and enjoy things like that. That's great.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. The only downside was I had a brand new puppy, which was difficult to train when you didn't really have the facility to train. I mean, going to put on a show, yes, we could put on a trial, but I really didn't have the room or space to train.
Right.
So it took a little bit longer to train the puppy to, I mean, he was really good, but it took a long time to get him acclimated. I mean, we were on the road all the time, and that was the only downfall. There was a couple of places that when we stayed for longer periods, I could train during the week, but when we rented fairgrounds, we only rented the weekend. We were allowed to camp there because most fairgrounds have campground spaces that you can rent to the public. So we would rent, but we didn't have access to the actual arena during the week, which was kind of a bummer, but it was so much fun. I would never say that anything was hard on us. We had a great time. It was a lot of fun.
Right. Now have you met, I don't really know you, and I know you've mentioned your dogs. What breed of dog is the dog that you've kind of run over the years, or have you run various breeds?
We started out with Belgian Taverns. Unfortunately, my Belgian Tavern decided agility was not something he wanted to do, so I ended up getting an Aussie puppy, and who went on, his idea was agility is his life. He loved agility. He did anything for agility, which was really kind of fun. So I started out with an Aussie. We had three other Aussies after that. but he was the first one was really the only one that wanted to do agility, and I had a good time with. And then when I lost him, we were up at the Cataldo camp. We spent the summer up at Cataldo every year after we started doing agility, all the fundraisers, and so Sharon invited us for the summer, and we would go up there and spend the whole summer there before championships. And she came out one day and said, I have a surprise for you. And we were actually in Moab doing a fundraiser when she brought out my first border collie and said, I'd like to give this to you. And I was absolutely shocked and thrilled at the same time because I had just lost my agility dog. So I started to train and work with him and Sharon and whatnot. We had a great time with my first border collie, and then after that it was border collies all the way. I enjoyed the border collie so much, so now we have between Jeannie and I, we have 8 border collies and 1 Australian Shepherd.
Okay, so you've kind of settled in onto the border collie, and but you still have an Australian Shepherd too. Okay, yeah.
Well, it's actually Jeannie's Australian Shepherd, and it was basically, she got the Australian Shepherd because a friend wanted her to put some herding titles and stuff on her because Jeannie does a lot of herding and has been very successful. So the breeder basically gave the puppy to Jeannie in hopes that she will do some great things in herding. So she's still a work in progress. She's still very young. So we'll see how it goes. But I do plan on training her in agility. We're just waiting for her to grow up a little bit more. We have plenty of dogs to deal with. We have 3 5-month-old puppies, border collie puppies in the house right now, which are taking up a lot of time, and it's quite chaotic here sometimes with all the puppies and the dogs.
Right. Okay. Now, you mentioned Jeannie, and I mean, I don't really know you. So, Jeannie... What's Jeannie's name?
It's Jeannie Biggers.
Right, okay.
We are best friends. Her husband is still living in Montana. He did not want to move from Montana, and she said, fine, I'm tired of the snow. I can't deal with it. And Jeannie and I became friends when we were doing fundraisers in Montana, and my husband Bruce and I stayed at their house many times, and we became very, very good friends. And when I lost my husband in 2001 or 11, she said, I had kind of nomaded around for a little bit because I was still living in my motorhome. And when I finally settled down, she says, you know, you ought to just come up and live with Corey and I. And I'm like, okay. And while we were living up in Montana for a few years, we kind of put together the idea that we wanted to open a training facility together. And we started looking around in Montana and realized we couldn't really afford Montana. So we started looking around in other areas that were NADAC oriented. And we kind of settled on Ontario, Oregon. There's a lot of NADAC there's a couple of clubs in the Boise area that do NADAC. So we didn't want to go to a brand new place that didn't have a clue what NADAC was, because that's harder. So we decided to purchase this place. She wanted to get into the herding and do instructions and whatnot. So she is doing training classes for herding, and we bought a place big enough that she can do her training and big enough that I can do the agility training. So it kind of fits both of us.
Right.
And it's been fantastic.
And I mean, I'll let you, I believe it's, is it Got Dog? What's the name of your facility?
It is Got Dog. You bet.
Okay. Oh, very good. All right. And now, since you did mention Jeannie, I'm going to just switch topic a little bit here. And now, I believe, and you can correct me, that both you and Jeannie do a lot of the judging of the virtual runs that are submitted to NADAC. Is that correct?
Yes, we do all the VT judging of the videos.
Right, okay.
That's one of my main jobs for subcontracting with NADAC.
Oh, okay. So you do that as a subcontractor to NADAC, judging the virtual trial runs, I guess, or the videotape. I guess it's videotaped runs is what it's
videotape
called.
program, yes.
Yeah, I don't know why I want to say virtual, but
people say that all the time, and it's really not.
Right.
Yeah.
So I know that you have. I have never been lucky enough to submit one, but I know my sister and her daughter, her Beagle Belle, they last year did do a number of videotaped runs that were submitted, and she got a number of cues, and she was pleased. That program during the pandemic has really allowed people to still get cues when. Last year in 2020, there weren't as many trials around.
Yeah, I don't know if there was any trials around. That was a crazy year, I'll tell you. But yeah, the VT program has been so supported by the NADAC community. It's unbelievable, and NADAC sure appreciates that, that's for sure.
Right. So I know on the forum I've occasionally seen some things. Can you offer some tips to people so that they don't waste an entry into the videotaped runs? Any suggestions?
The only I do see occasionally, people will turn in video runs, especially in regular, well, actually only in regular, with a knocked bar. It's one of the few differences between the VT program and a regular NADAC trial is you could not have a knocked bar in the VT program. So I feel really bad when people send it in thinking they can get a 5-point cue and they can't. So that would probably be the biggest issue of an NQ other than, missed contacts or something that they didn't notice or whatever. It doesn't happen very often. I don't NQ runs very often, but the biggest one is definitely the knocked bar.
Right. Okay. Because that is, I know that is one of the rules. You can't get that dropped bar in the
Right.
videotaped and regular. Okay. And I know on the page, I think it does say things about, trying to get the angles for all the contacts, because obviously if you can't see the contacts, then it's hard for you
Right, exactly.
to judge it. Right.
Well,
Yeah.
what I found, the biggest issue is, like, a lot of the small space courses, there's just one contact and the dog is only running in one direction over the contact, yet the videographer never ever shows us the contact zone. They're always standing down at the bottom of the ring or something. So my biggest thing is for people to actually think about where they're going to film from so we can see the actual line or the yellow contact zone or whatever color it happens to be. It's not always yellow. And I think that's the biggest thing. People don't realize they can stand anywhere in the ring. I've had people stand in the middle of the ring and just circle as the dog goes around, but at least shows me all the contact zones.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest, the videographer goes, "Oh, I'm just going to stand down here by the start line." Well, it doesn't always work for showing us contacts. I mean, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I do realize that there's times where the contacts are going in opposite directions, and all you can do is give us hopefully some sort of visual of the dog getting to the end of a contact zone. And, if it's iffy, then I have to determine whether it was too iffy and therefore an NQ, or if it, if the dog goes all the way to the bottom on a 2-on-2-off, it's obviously, even though I can't see the yellow, it's pretty obvious he hit the contact.
Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. All right. So thanks for that. And I'll just say, having, I often was the one actually making the submission for my sister. I mean, she ran for, she ran her dog, but often I was the one that, did the form and submitted it. And
Sure.
the other thing I would say, oh, I'm blanking now. Where was I going with this? You want to submit that? Oh, the obviously there's a course that, was set, and I'm not a course builder. Last year we had the opportunity to do VTs with a local dog school who was doing it. Unfortunately, they're not doing it this year in New Jersey. We don't have a lot of trials, so we really miss that ability. But having the course set, then you also had that course calculator. So you knew you know, you would watch after you, you know, you took the video home, you could time it yourself watching it and use the course calculator to know if that was, you know, once or twice. I think we might have had one that I think was an NQ because it was just too close or something. But you kind of could use that course calculator on the NADAC site to know if you, you made time or not.
Right. I agree. And I do find that the majority of the NQs are from overtime because people don't either understand how to fill out the course calculator or they don't know about it. You'd be surprised how many people do the program and have never read the rules or what's capable for them in regards to pulling up the maps or doing the course calculator or knowing how to fill out the form. I know if you go to the website and you go to the submission form, there's a very nice big instruction page prior to going into the submission form. But if you only submit on your phone, you can't read it because it's too small. And people don't. I get more errors on submissions from using their phone because they can't find, there's no instruction for them. I always recommend everybody to, you can take the picture, you know, the videos on your phone, submit them to YouTube on your phone, but I would then go on my computer and submit the submission form using your computer and logging into your YouTube account at that point to get your video link. I highly recommend it because on the phone you're limited to what you can do on the submission form, and I get a lot of errors of names of courses, which is an input issue, but the class name, and on the submission form, if you remember, the default class is Elite Regular 1.
Okay.
That's what's filled in, and you have a pull-down menu, and you select. And what happens is I get a lot of videos that are labeled Elite Regular 1, and it's not. So then I have to go through a process of letting Chris know to move the queue from regular to whatever the course was that they ran in hopes that the video is telling me what level they're running in, especially if it's a games class that all run the same level,
right?
Like Tumblers or Touch and Go. If they put down it's Elite Regular 1 or they didn't realize it, it defaulted back because they didn't select the name. Even though you highlight it, you got to select it.
Right.
And it has to actually fill the field. But the hardest thing is if it's a non, you know, class that I don't know what it is, then I have to contact, which creates time. I have to email them. They have to email me back, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So it's really important that everyone remembers to always look at the form before they submit or check out, because things get defaulted and the class is the biggest thing.
Right. So. Yeah. No, I understand. And I'm going to admit to something here. My sister might get upset when she listens to this, but now you mentioned the games classes. Now I remember last year, I don't know if it was Touch and Go or if it was Tunnelers. I can't remember, but my sister's dog really is an elite, but she didn't make time that time. According to the calculator, she didn't make it. So I just said, well, you know what? NADAC doesn't care. You can still get a queue if you want. And we just submitted it as open. We just stepped down and waited open and we got the queue.
Yeah, I know a lot of people do that because I see elite dogs that are slow and they don't qualify exactly in Tunnelers or Touch and Go. And yeah, we don't care. I don't know any different. So if you want to get the lower queue, then so be it. I mean, it's not
exactly
legal at a trial because you can only enter one level.
That's right. So, it's kind of a benefit for a video taped run that you can do that. Right. You can't do that at trial. If you enter as elite, trying for that, you can't.
What I don't know won't hurt me.
Right, exactly. And I'm just saying that it's actually one of the advantages to that, to the videotape for the courses that are all the same. So yes, my sister got 10 points, but you know, you're in, and there's many things, and like there's the lifetime points and things like that. So it adds up. It might be,
I mean,
it's worth the $10 for that cube.
Yeah, it's your $10. So if you want to spend it on a lower cube and earn lifetime points, then so be it.
Yes. Okay. All right.
Everybody wins.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And I did it. I don't know if I checked with her. all right. I think we've talked about the videotaped, runs, which I wanted to ask you about because I knew you had done them many. And I've noticed that some of the short courses recently have been designed by you.
Yes,
do you enjoy trying to design those small space, I guess I should call it, the small space courses?
They're quite challenging, but I took the challenge to Jimmy because he was saying, I'm so burned of making small spaces. They're so, you know, they're difficult because they're small spaces. And I said, well, let me do a couple. I know you're going to be busy, and I just had foot surgery, so I'm sitting on my butt for 6 weeks. So I said, I'm sure I will have time. I will make a couple sets so you can take a break. So him and Amanda usually do them. Occasionally another judge will do them. But I enjoy making courses. Did it for years. Still do. But it's the small spaces, the 60 by 60, is very challenging to make them original because there's just so much you can do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a judge. I'm not a course builder, but I can imagine that's the case because it's a small, you know, that's small. Fortunately, it's still too large for any yard that I have available to me. But I understand that you can only go so small.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And last year in 2020, sometimes the video. The run, let's say the run that the St. Hubert School had put up, you know, set up was the smaller space just because it was easier. You didn't need to drag as much equipment out, and it was still fun to go try and do it. So, you know, even though they had 100 by 100 field, they were sometimes doing that small space course. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Yeah. So I know course designing, and that's, a whole nother challenge that judges get to do now because judges a lot of times design their own courses, which may not have been the way it was in the past.
Right. Well, it's, I'm glad that NADAC has decided to allow the judges to start designing because you're going to get a little more originality instead of having the same set of judges create courses throughout the years. And we're seeing a lot more. And plus, I think it also helps the judges really learn more about the dog and dog path when they see it run on their own course, if that makes sense.
It does to me. Yeah, you design the course and then you see where you succeeded and maybe where you failed a bit, right? I can
exactly.
see that. Yeah.
Exactly. Like you know, you can watch it and go, oh yeah, I'm not going to do that again. That didn't work out very well. It looked good on paper, but it didn't run like I thought it was going to run. So I've had that experience. I've been judging for almost 25 years and I still to this day can design a course and go, I really like this. And then it gets put on the ground and I'm like, nope, this sequence didn't work. So it happens to the best of us and I think we all learn from it.
Right. Okay. All right. So I think we're going to transition to a slightly different topic now, too. I have attended, I'm not as a competitor, but I have attended the 2017 NADAC Championships with my sister and her dog, Belle. And I have attended the 2019 NADAC Championships with my sister and her dog. And I was there with my newer dog, Trace, and we just ran a little, I think we ran in the pre-trial, but he really, well, even now, he's kind of an intro dog. We didn't do that well, but it was fun running him, even though we were running novice courses at the pre-trial to see how he did. And I even did a few side runs, but none of it went well, super well, but I did go. But I know I remember that you are a stakes competitor. So you enjoy doing that distance thing with your dogs. Have you always been like that, or did that come along later?
No, that came along later. Having grown up in NADAC with Sharon, who has always done distance work and decided that let's really push the envelope and work bigger and bigger distances. So I kind of got hooked when I spent so much time with Sharon in the summer doing seminars and distance work and whatnot. And I had a dog that excelled. When you own a border collie who wants to run, it just comes natural. So you kind of get hooked. It's like being on cloud nine and it's a rush when everything is going as planned. I mean, yeah, you're going to crash and burn a lot because distance is a tough thing to do successfully. And there's a handful of people in the United States that can actually do it. So it's just a rush to be able to direct your dog verbally through a course and be successful at it. It's mind-boggling. You just come off the course and your heart's pounding at 100 miles an hour because things are getting excited. You know you're getting to the end and all you have to do is put them through that last obstacle and it's like, it's just amazing. It's an amazing feeling.
Right. I know from having watched, you know, that portion of championships, it is so impressive to see people working their dogs from that distances. And sometimes, you know, there's failures, but the communication between the handler and the dog, it amazes me. It really does. It just amazes me. And I know some dogs just can't. You know, I guess I shouldn't say the word can't, but it's can be difficult. My sister and her dog, her beagle, they are very Velcro-y. They have trouble with chances. It's been a perennial problem class for them. But
most of the dogs that have done, I can't say for all of them because I don't know all of them, but most of the dogs that are in the stakes division were trained from the get-go to work the distance class. And
right.
So you have a different communication with the dog. It's mostly verbal. It's not so much physical. Like your sister, you're saying she's a Velcro dog. And it's what you've taught the dog. So
yes.
In the stakes division, those dogs have been taught from the get-go how to work away from the handler. So it's not something that someone does and then decides years down the road, oh, I want to do bonus work. Most of the time, it's very difficult for someone to do that because that's not how the dog was trained. And some dogs slow down because you're working farther and farther away. So I think the most successful ones out there are the ones that have started the dog at the beginning with distance work.
Right. That makes a lot of sense to me. It definitely does. So I know, and I haven't gotten very far with my dog Trace, but I do, like, I try not to ever discourage him from going away from me. That's one thing.
Oh, absolutely.
So
I would have to say that 90% of our students that have come to us from other venues or word of mouth or whatever have come to us because they can't do chances. And they need to know how to teach their dog how to work distance. And we're not talking bonus line distances, but they have to learn to teach the dog that it's okay. I don't have to be running right next to you, that you can move away and still be successful. So distance is something that you definitely have to teach. It doesn't always come natural. Even with border collies or herding breeds, distance isn't always a natural thing. It needs to be taught to the dog.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what kind of breed it is. You can teach a dog to have distance as long as the dog understands that you're still a partner and you're still a team, and the relationship between you and the dog is the key.
Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I understand it, but I don't know if I'll ever be able to do it. But it's amazing to see when you're at champs to see all the different levels. I think there's three levels of stakes.
Yes, absolutely. When there's going to be quite a few more starter stakes classes or dog entries this year, which I'm excited to see because that means people are getting more involved with the distance work and the big distance work, I should say. So that's exciting that the starter class is going to be much bigger than it was last time. Are you coming to the Ohio Championships this year?
I am planning to be there in once again, I'm coming as a support personnel and a spectator kind of. I
Oh,
will
cool.
my dog Trace will be in the pre-trial, and my
Nice.
sister's dog Belle will be, I guess she's in elite. We'll see how she does. She's not been doing that good at trials this year, but she actually is a qualified dog because she had
Nice.
gotten in 2020 from the videotaped cues. She
I know.
legitimately has 10 elite regular cues.
Well, cool. That's perfect.
Yeah, so I mean, she is actually legally qualified to be there by
That's
old
nice.
rules. I mean, I know the rules are
Oh,
kind of out the window a bit this
the old
time,
very bottom.
but she's going. My sister, when I first started with my first dog Dino, I got very frustrated at one point, and I learned you have to have fun. The dog has to
Oh, yeah.
have fun, and you need to have fun. And if you're not having fun, just give it up. So I
Right.
changed my mindset, and so my sister also has that mindset. It's to have fun.
Well, you know, everybody should have the mindset because if you're not having fun, what's the point?
Right. I definitely agree with you.
As a judge, I always say in my briefing that when you leave the ring, one of your team members, you or your dog, should be smiling. And I don't care if it's the dog or you, but one of them needs to be smiling when you're leaving the ring.
Right.
Somebody, one of the teammates has to be having fun.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I like when judges, over the years, I've always liked when judges say things like that in the briefing. It's kind of sad that still in this pandemic, a lot of times the briefings are shorter
Right.
than they used to be. You don't get so much from the judges, and I hope we get over the pandemic maybe next year. Keep my
Yeah, I
fingers
think it's
crossed.
getting better, so hopefully we'll be having more NADAC trials and people will be getting out more. I'm hopeful.
Right. Now, you've mentioned that you are a judge. I'm just going to go back to the judging a little bit. Over the years, you've done a lot of trials. I don't know. Do you still go to trials and judge, or because you're doing so many other things that you don't do that so much anymore?
Well, when my husband and I were going around the United States promoting NADAC, we were doing up to 35 trials a year,
Whew.
35 weekends. And
Wow.
people all would say, "Oh, can you come judge?" And I'd literally say, "I can't. I don't have time. I don't have an available weekend. And when I do have an available weekend, I don't want to be judging." Because
Sure.
that's what I've been doing all year. So now that I am not going around the country for NADAC, I do get assignments and occasionally I have to turn them down. This past year with the pandemic, the VT program was going so strong that we were literally watching videos every single day, which means we're judging every single day.
Right.
And people, "Oh, you want to come judge?" And I would look at Dina and go, "I've already judged 300 or 400 videos this week. I don't really want to go somewhere on a weekend and stand and do it when I can be
Right.
sitting in my recliner and do it."
Yeah.
So the VT program has really kind of put a squash on my need to go judge somewhere.
Sure.
I have judged a couple of times for some local clubs that I have have really good friends with in an area that I grew up. So occasionally I will go judge for my local friends. So that's probably about the only judging that I've really done. I was supposed to go up to Montana, but with the pandemic that got shut down last year. So everything has kind of been put on hold because of the pandemic. But in reality, I don't take a lot of assignments because I'm doing so much judging at home that sure. the thought of going and judge at a trial has not been on my things to do.
Right, right. Now, I'm going to go back to the videotape just for a second because I got to ask this question because I've often thought it. When you judge that, do you have a very large screen? Because I've noticed over the, you know, because I'm also a voyeur, I'll say, of other people's videotapes. Not so much recently, but last year, I watched a lot of videotape runs, just kind of just curiosity. And sometimes it was very hard for me on my little laptop screen to see things. So I was wondering if you know, when you're judging it, do you have it on like a big screen TV or a big computer monitor?
Actually, I've watched 99% of the videos on a Surface Pro.
Really? Okay. So that's not that big.
No, but the advantage in some instances is YouTube allows you to enlarge it to, it completely covers my screen. Most of the time when I open the video, it's probably the size of a 3x5 card. And if I need to actually see something enlarged, then I will enlarge it. Plus, I can zoom in. So when someone does show me a contact that's kind of iffy, I can put it in slow-mo and zoom in to just that contact point. And majority of the time, I can tell if the dog hit the contact or not. There's only a few times where it's not a very good quality of film, so I can't actually pinpoint the contact zone, but I haven't really had a lot of problems. If there's something really iffy, then I will take it to a monitor and look at it on a bigger screen. But the majority of the time I can tell just by blowing it up and putting it in slow-mo, which I had someone do the other day, and she sent me the video and says, I don't know if I should turn this in. And I'm like, well, if you don't think it's good, then why are you asking me? You know, don't turn it in if you think it's iffy, because I will probably feel the same way.
Right. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, and that's not fair to be prejudging something. You got to submit it for and pay your $10.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So I'm going to go back to Champs because I want to get to one of the reasons why I asked you to be on my podcast this month is because Champs is next month in October, and yeah. I saw your message about the basket raffle. So I'm going to get to that, but I have one question about Champs. Since you've been involved with NADAC for so long, first of all, do you know when was the first championships? Do you know the answer to that?
1995.
Wow.
In, I do believe the Mount Rainier trial was the championships in Washington, state of Washington. I don't remember. Might have been Columbia, Washington. I don't recall.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not trying to. I can't tell you. Yeah.
It was on the West Coast because that's basically where NADAC started.
Right. Okay. So, wow. So the first Champs was around 1995. Wow.
I believe so. I think they started in 93, and I think the first championships was 95. I could be wrong. It might have been 94, but I'm pretty sure it was 95.
Okay. And then I would imagine they had one pretty much every year since then.
Yes.
Yeah. So
last year was the first year that we did not have a championship since NADAC started.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, because of the pandemic, it got canceled mm-hmm. out in the, and yeah. that was a Western, I kind of think of it as Western Eastern. I know that's not always been the case over the years, but yeah, that was the Western one that was out in Gillette that got canceled. And now it's back this year. It's supposed
right.
to be back.
Exactly.
Well, it's going to be back in Springfield, Ohio. So, okay. All right. I was curious about that. Now, How do you know how many of those you may have gone to over all those years?
I'd have to think about that, but I'm thinking, let's see, 2011, I've been everyone there. I'm probably 20.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So you've been there. You've been going to them a long time. And
yeah, I think my first one was in 1996. I think that was in Scottsdale, Arizona. 96 or 97. Might have been 97. And then I missed a few that were back east because I know they had some in Minnesota that I did not go to.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah, there's probably a handful that I did not go to.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's a question for someone else in a future podcast about all the places maybe Champs has been. But yeah, all right, I appreciate that. So I know that you put out a message recently about the, I'll call it the state baskets at championships.
Correct.
And have you, I kind of think you're kind of somewhat in charge of that, at least for this year. Have you been involved with that for a number of years with the raffle baskets?
Yes, I have been for many, many years. I think the last, at the very beginning, there was usually a local club that did the raffle. And then at some point when I do believe Sharon Nelson moved the championships to Gillette. And in Gillette, there is no agility in Gillette. That was just, but it's an amazing facility. So there wasn't any local co-ops to support it. So she asked if I could be in charge of the raffle. And I don't remember who came up with the idea. It might have been my husband. I don't know. He always comes up with some great ideas about state baskets and have a raffle for our every state or club that wants to put a raffle together. And when we started doing that, it went over like, it was amazing. It was like the people in the clubs and the people coming from different states were so enthusiastic about putting together some amazing baskets. I mean, I've seen baskets that took up half the table of stuff. I mean, amazing things like crates and dog pools and wagons and just loaded with stuff, and it was awesome. And when we started selling the tickets, my husband says, we need something that will get people to buy tickets. And I'm like, well, you know, what do? They sell for, you know, you buy $1 and you get a ticket, and, you know, for $5 you get 7 tickets. And he goes, no, we need something that people want to buy a big dollar amount. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he goes, let's do $100 will get you 300 tickets.
Wow.
And I'm like, well, okay, we can do that. So I put it down and I named it the Bruce Vincent Special. And we only sold those tickets on one day. So on Wednesday, before the show starts, we will sell tickets for the raffle with your special. And I tell you what, that was a huge hit. We had more people buying tickets because, look, you got 300 tickets. Your chances of winning just went up tremendously with 300 tickets.
Right.
So that was a huge windfall for selling tickets for the raffle and getting people interested in the raffle and putting more items in the raffle, because the bigger the raffle, the more tickets got put in the bags. So it just became a huge event that we stopped the show, we did the raffle, everybody gathered around, it was announced over the loudspeaker. I mean, it was a huge event, and everyone was absolutely enthralled with the winnings, and people were trading afterwards. Oh, I'll trade you this for this. It was just a lot of fun. And people were, I think Jeannie's mom was a quilter, and she made a quilt out of all the NADAC t-shirts. Took the logo off the shirt, the front, and made it into a I think it was like an 8x8 quilt, like a queen size bed quilt with all the prior NADAC champion shirts. It was amazing. We raffled that off separate, actually. But that was like really cool. But things people have done that over the years, just come up with some amazing stuff and all the things in the basket that represent that state. It's just pretty cool. I really have enjoyed doing the state basket raffle.
Right. And having, well, let's first say the Bruce Vincent special still exists, and it only happens on Wednesday, right? That's the day you got to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I will say, for anybody that is not going to be there in time, you can pay in advance for your tickets, and I will hold them for you. So if anybody wants to purchase $100 worth of tickets, all they need to do is send money via PayPal through the NADAC address, the support@NADAC.com, and state that it's for the raffle basket, and Chris will let me know, and I will make sure that 300 tickets are waiting for them when they do arrive, because some people aren't getting to the show site until Wednesday evening, and I think we close this ticket sales at 5 o'clock.
Okay, very good. That's good to know for anybody who's not going to arrive in time.
And I would recommend anybody, if you do buy the 300 tickets, that you bring like address labels with your name on them, so you're not having to write that 300 times. You just put a sticker on the back, and that's sufficient.
Yeah. Okay. The first time I went to Champs, I don't know if we did the special, but last time we did, my sister and I split the 300 up. She wisely brought some stickers. I was writing my name on tickets for a long time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I do recommend getting labels or doing whatever, even if it's just your name and whatever. We don't hold anything. You do have to be present
to pick it up,
or have someone, you know, you've made arrangements for them, if you happen to win a basket, to bring it home for you. But we do not ship anything. So,
right. And I will say there are some people coming from New Jersey, but my sister and I are going to definitely make a small New Jersey basket that will be there representing the state of New Jersey. And there may be more New Jersey stuff, but we're going to do a nice small basket for New Jersey.
You know, the forum is a perfect place for people to connect, to say, okay, we're going to bring a New Jersey basket or product for the basket or whatever. And if there's any other New Jersey people, you know, contact you, but whatever, and just make one big basket instead of having, you know, little ones or whatever.
Yeah. But I thought you actually suggested that it would be a good idea to keep some of them smaller.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
More winning. More winning is fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we wouldn't want 5 New Jersey baskets, but I don't think that will be the case.
Yeah. Well, some of the clubs, which are very large and they end up with huge baskets, we have requested that they make smaller ones, you know, 2 or 3 out of the bigger ones, because some of them were so big. I don't even know how people got them in their car.
Right.
Because there was so much stuff in their basket.
Right. Now I have a question from my sister about this, and she's just curious. Do you personally do tricky trays or brown bag raffles on your own? Do you enjoy doing that, or it just became a part of the championships that you started doing this?
You mean as far as putting raffles on at shows?
Or going to, yeah. My sister likes to go. In New Jersey, there's organizations that have, they call it a tricky tray. It's very similar. You know, you buy a set of tickets,
fundraiser
for some charity or something, or organization. They have it very similar with that. You put your tickets in whatever you like, and then usually you sit down at tables, and they might have some cookies and coffee and stuff. This was pre-pandemic, obviously. And somebody calls all the things out, and then they, you know, you won whatever it was that you put your ticket, you know, if you were lucky, you won. So,
right.
Yeah. Do you do that yourself?
I've never heard of that. It sounds intriguing. But I have put on a couple of fundraisers for an organization that my husband started, in California when we were there. he started a nonprofit organization called Starfleet K9 Aid. Our agility organization was called Starfleet Agility. So we started an organization that receives money, and it's 100% nonprofit. All the funds go to paying people that can't afford veterinary care or whatever. Let's say a dog gets hit by a car, has a broken leg, and the person has no choice but to either put the dog down or have surgery that they can't afford. So we step in and help pay some of the medical bills so they can apply for money from our organization and help pay the medical bills for whatever reason, as long as it's a reason that the dog is going to survive. We usually don't do cancer unless it's a survivable cancer, but we don't make money for where the dog doesn't have a chance. You know, we do it so dogs can stay in their family. So we did fundraisers throughout the year at different trials. Usually a raffle would usually take place at a certain trial for that nonprofit organization. And there's a club in California that all their trials that they put on, half their proceeds from the trial go to the foundation. Oh, so that's... we've been keeping it going ever since. Even though my husband's been passed for 10 years, that foundation is still going, which is his little legacy that he thought would be something to have before he died.
So. Yeah, okay. And that sounds like a very fine thing to do. I got to ask, though, just Starfleet, was your husband a big fan of Star Trek?
Oh, absolutely. We were both Trekkies. Matter of fact, every single one of our dogs, except my last one, has a Star Trek name.
Okay, wow. All right.
Are you a Trekkie?
So, big Trekkies. I don't know if I would call myself a Trekkie, but I'm definitely a fan of the original Star Trek, and I've seen a lot of Star Trek over the years. Yes. Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yep. Definitely seen a lot of Star Trek, so don't know if I'd call myself a Trekkie, but yeah, I enjoy Star Trek.
Yeah, I've watched every episode of Star Trek there ever been. I've been to all the movies, but I wouldn't say I'm a Trekkie with that. I would go to Comic-Con, you know, whatever,
yeah.
Or a Star Trek convention or anything like that, but we really enjoyed Star Trek.
Okay, that's good. Well, I see by the clock that we have filled almost an hour because you are so knowledgeable and have so many areas. And I do thank you, Marge, for being a part of my podcast. And I look forward to meeting you in person, hopefully, in Springfield, Ohio next month.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate it. It was quite a pleasure. Thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the raffle or anything else before we wrap it up here?
No, other than I'm looking forward to seeing people I haven't seen in quite a while.
Yeah, that's always a nice thing at Champs, too, just seeing people that you've met over the years at different trials and different locations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or all the people that I've watched during VT runs.
Yeah, for you, that must be amazing. Yes, I could see that.
Fun.
That would be amazing to see all the and see a lot of those dogs in person too. Then, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, once again, I thank you very much for being on the podcast, and I thank you for getting back to me when I asked you to come on and be my guest this month.
Perfect. Well, thank you.
All
Have
right.
a good evening.
You too. Goodbye.
Okay.
And I'm back with a quick final. As always, I thank all my listeners for listening. And if you have any feedback for me or any questions at all, you can always email at offcourse@optimum.net. You can always find that in the show notes of the podcast on each and every episode. A programming note. My next episode might be a little off cycle. I'm thinking I'll release a topical type episode, dealing probably with planning for going to Champs, at least my planning. I might even have my sister join me for a bit on that one. But 2 weeks from the 15th is the 29th of September, and that's too close to actually the NADAC Championship. So I think I'm going to back it up, and I'll probably release that episode the weekend, somewhere around the weekend of September 25th will likely be my next episode. Until then, if you're going to a trial or you're doing videotaped runs, I wish you happy trialing.